Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, bringing the concerns of the Middle Eastern Church to this month's Synod in Rome. Peace building, Mideast, and evangelization. We speak to a Catholic expert and helping women help themselves and the church through the internet and new media. On Sunday, the Synod for the New Evangelization gets underway here in the Vatican, drawing bishops, cardinals, and patriarchs from around the world to share their experiences and discuss ways to bring the Catholic Church into a new era, re-energizing a hackneyed faithful and reaching out to those who have yet to believe in Jesus Christ. In Lebanon in September to report on Pope Benedict's visit to present the conclusions of the 2010 Synod for the Middle East, I had the opportunity to look ahead to this October's Synod with Catholic Maronite Archbishop Paul Saya. He and his patriarch, Beshara Rai, will be telling bishops here at this month's Synod what challenges Christians in the Middle East are facing today and what these mean to new evangelization in the region. But first, can a country like Lebanon, which Pope John Paul II called a message of pluralism and a beacon of religious freedom, offer a model for a Middle East in the throes of an Arab Spring which shows no sign of waning?
I should hope so, and I think it will. I think everybody in the region is longing for peace, longing for this Arab awakening to lead to some different way of being, a different way for the communities to relate to each other. And I think looking at Lebanon, you know, they will certainly, I think, you know, feel that this is the way. And we are convinced, again, with all the ups and downs, you know, that one goes through, I think for the Arab Spring, for those countries where you have different religions, different ethnicities, that's the only way through. You have to share power, you have to respect each other, you have to try to be as secular as possible in the positive sense. If they're going to go back to having Islam as the religion of the state in countries like Egypt or Tunisia or Libya or anywhere, and I think they would be back to square one. So I do think that the example of Lebanon during the visit of the Pope, and on the whole, people are more ready now to take it because they're looking for a way out of this mess that many countries are in now after the Arab awakening. And I don't think they have much choice, you know, if they want to really live in a democratic environment. They have to live together, respect each other, share the power, and allow people to be what they want to be.
So you think that this message of freedom of religion, of freedom of conscience here in the Middle East, this message that Pope Benedict was bringing with him here to Lebanon, that will in some way be espoused?
I think freedom of religion, yes, more than freedom of conscience. I think freedom of conscience will still remain a problem in many, if not most, of the Arab countries, especially where they still think of Islam as being the religion of the state. Now, freedom of religion, we hope it will be less problematic.
But, for example, here in Lebanon, if a Muslim wanted to change his faith and convert to Christianity, is that accepted?
Well, in Lebanon, yes. We have, first of all, by law, it's accepted. Lebanon, as you know, is a secular country. We don't have a religion for the state. Yes, the freedom of conscience in Lebanon is guaranteed. People who want to change their religion, they can, of course. Even when people marry with a person from another faith, say a Christian marrying a Muslim or a Muslim marrying a Christian, both have the choice to remain where they are and live and accept each other and agree on how they want to raise their children. by agree together. But Lebanon is the only country in the Middle East where you have this freedom of conscience. And even in Lebanon, in some very remote areas, some Muslims would find it difficult to accept it. But I mean, it's accepted officially in Lebanon, so there's no problem that way.
Tell me about plans for the Patriarch going off to the new Evangelization Synod in October. Is he going to be bringing something with him to those discussions?
Well, of course, he will not be going alone. And he will bring with him the concerns of the Christians of the Middle East, Christians of Lebanon, of course. But our Patriarch, Shararai, is the president of the Council of Patriarchs for the Middle East. So he has a role beyond the Mennonite Church and beyond Lebanon. He certainly will be bringing the concerns, and will be bringing the experiences also, because each region or each church has a way of perceiving evangelization and how to do it, most effectively. That way, I think he will make a contribution, especially now, again, with the situation of the Christians in the Middle East, which is a very difficult situation. Evangelizing our people now is all the more urgent because our people are going through huge problems in all the countries of the Middle East. In Iraq, you know what happened to them. In Syria now, things are very bad. In Egypt, you know how it is. We have a new reality in the Middle East, and we have to deal with that new reality. How do you offer Jesus Christ? How do you offer the gospel to those troubled people? You know, the people who are very iffy about what's going on, what's going to happen to them, and the future. You're dealing with a very troubled society. You know, I think the Patriarch will be sensitizing the synod to this new reality that the Christians of the Middle East are experiencing at the moment.
It is a dramatic moment for the Middle East. It has been since we saw the war in Iraq. How do you bring a new evangelization to people who are fleeing violence, who are fleeing economic problems here, who can't find jobs?
Well, of course, this is the million-dollar question. That's a huge, big challenge. But I think you have to start dealing with the immediate and most urgent needs of the people. And this is what the church has been trying to do in Lebanon with the refugees coming from Syria. I think if you bring Jesus Christ to those people, you have to bring you have to bring the loving Christ. You have to bring the caring Christ. And this comes in all sorts of ways. It comes through the presence of the church close to those people. It comes through offering them what they need. It comes through also helping them rediscover their own commitment as Christians. One of the great things about Christianity is that you have to learn to trust in God. I think this is a vital dimension in Christian faith. You have to surrender yourself to God. If we can get this message across to them, I think this will give them some hope, while at the same time being present to them spiritually, economically, psychologically. I think this is probably the way. At this time, you know, when, as you say, they're all over the place, they're not settled in one particular place, the main thing is to be there, to be present, and do what you can to show them that they're not left alone. I think this is one way of reminding them of the presence of God in the world through the church.
And a very warm thanks there to Archbishop Paul Saya, the Vicar General of the Maronite Patriarchate in Bikirke, Lebanon. Peace building among communities and faiths has long been a part of Catholic social teaching, And it's not just about building up peace between countries or communities at war. Even when bombs aren't falling and guns fall silent, the Catholic Church says social relationships have to be rebuilt and victims of violence rehabilitated with a vision for the long term. Marianne Cusimano-Love, Associate Professor of International Relations at the Catholic University of America, is one of the Church's leading experts on peace building and an expert on terrorism. She is on the core group for the U.S. State Department's Working Group on Religion and Foreign Policy and serves on the U.S. Catholic Bishops' International Justice and Peace Committee. I asked Professor Love how Christians, Muslims, and Jews can contribute to world peace today, and realistically, how can they cooperate towards that goal?
I think one of the things that's important to note is we're at a time when states are challenged around the world in dealing with many problems, from terrorism to ethnic violence to civil wars, and religion is resurgent around the world. So you're looking, where are there some functional capacity that we can have to try to build peace? And religions can be a very important source of that. And I know that seems counterintuitive, you know, because certainly since September 11th, but often religion is painted as the bad guy, the source of war, or else religion is unimportant. You know, the idea that Joseph Stalin said during the Second World War, how many divisions does the Pope have? You know, if you don't have armies, you can't be very important. But I think that really overlooks the tremendous power that religious organizations have in providing education and providing health care and providing emergency and humanitarian assistance. And in that work, they build relationships. They build relationships with people on the ground in areas of conflict so that when war comes and governments are not able to respond, who can you talk to who has relationships with the people, who may be able to bring the combatants to the peace table, who certainly are able to serve the displaced, the refugees, the internally displaced, the victims of conflict, and who have a rich on-the-ground knowledge. So I think first is that religious groups can be very helpful and are very helpful in building peace around the world. The second part is how these traditions can work together. And that's increasingly important because not only is religion resurgent and states are challenged, but globalization is mixing. It's mixing everyone together. So increasingly, places that had not been previously pluralistic in religion now are. So we're finding that we have to work together much more than we have been perhaps in the past. And there have been really exciting breakthroughs in that. Archbishop Ledesma from the Philippines, he has been working for almost 30 years now with the Bishop's Ulama Dialogue in the southern area of the Philippines where there's been ongoing conflict. And the imams and the bishops have been working together to build relationships, to build trust across the religious borders and to help build peace there.
One of the things that Pope Benedict has been urging Catholics to do is to jumpstart this new evangelization. But sometimes evangelization can lead to conversion, and that itself is an issue between different faith communities. How do we not start wars, but we bring peace about through this also, this very Catholic initiative of new evangelization?
Mm-hmm. Evangelization can take many forms. And for the peace builders around the world, one of the most important forms is through our deeds. They will know we are Christians by our love. So Caritas Internationalis, which is one of the main relief and humanitarian aid organizations of the Church, they serve all based on need, not by creed. And they are not allowed in many situations to be passing out Bibles or offering baptism, but many times people, after experiencing the work of the Church and the care of the Church, are so moved by that witness of Christ's presence in the world that they then ask, can I know more about your faith? What is it in your faith that brings you to serve me? And I am not of your tribe, of your ethnicity, of your religion, yet you are caring more for me than sometimes people who might share some of those characteristics with me. So I think you're right if you are, that can often cause concerns. But the way we go about it is very important. And if we are known by our deeds, I think that can go quite a long way to generating goodwill. One thing that's very interesting is many times the Church, in areas where they are a minority, are doing workshops across their diocese, across the country, available to people from all faith backgrounds. So training workshops in human rights, in civic participation, in what the constitutional rights are and how they can try to proceed to peacefully resolve conflicts. And so they're using Catholic social teaching and they're generating these workshops for the population, but not by the basis of creed or ethnic background. These are open to all. So it's very interesting the ways in which even minority, places where the church is very much a minority, where they can be kind of a leaven for the larger society.
So I'd like to ask one question about the Middle East and the big sweeping changes that we're seeing there, the Middle East and North Africa. Is the international community morally responsible for what happens in that region of the world? And is it accountable for peace between majority and minority communities?
Right. So the responsibility to protect is something that's an emerging norm at the United Nations, an emerging norm in international law, and certainly something the Catholic Church has been very vibrant in pursuing, this responsibility to protect. But the responsibility does not tell you at what point it becomes an obligation to use military force to protect civilians who are being killed by their own government. And, of course, that's the hard part. The responsibility to protect says we all have responsibilities. Most of the responsibilities are non-military in nature. Every way that you can try to prevent the conflict, to avert the conflict, to stop it once it's underway. So military force is the absolute last tier in that system. But at what point does there become an obligation to protect those when their governments are doing the killing? And that's the choice, obviously, that the international community is facing now in Syria and faced last year in Libya. Of course, everyone's hope is that it won't come to that. It's still unknown in the situation in Syria. Who has control of those forces? Does the president have control of the military? Is the military undergoing this on its own? So there's still a lot of questions unknown. But that's where the church can help build these institutions, can help build the norms about putting humans first, putting people first, whereas the typical response of states is, we need to first protect the state. And the churches play a very important role in saying we need to put people first and we need to put human security before state security. And that's where interreligious voices are very important in raising up the important value of human life.
How can families also contribute to world peace?
Well, one of the things we talked about in education, are we teaching peace in our families? Are we helping people appreciate, are we helping our children appreciate our vocation to be peace builders, that it's not for the governments of countries to do, and this isn't a job for soldiers and diplomats, that this is a job for all of us to build peace in our families, to build peace in our communities, to build peace among communities of difference with different ethnic and religious groups, and to go out with confidence. Because we are followers of the Prince of Peace. This is what he gave us. This is the mission he instilled in us. This is the mission our church sends us out for. So we're not doing something unknown. We're doing something that's very much at the heart of the Christian tradition and enabling our families to do that and encouraging that, both in terms of conflict resolution within families, and so many families are facing fractures within their families, as well as externally.
Marianne Love, Associate Professor of International Relations at the Catholic University of America. Empowering women in the church and in the world to harness the potential of new media to improve their professional skills and, why not, to evangelize. That's the aim of the Institute for Higher Women's Studies at the Rome-based Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum, which recently added a high-powered program to its curricula featuring experts from Google, Microsoft, Facebook, TED, and other heavyweights in the field of digital and social communications. Computer security experts offer hands-on training, beginning with how to protect internet users from online identity and financial theft. Students also learn how to create online businesses and to develop marketing and advertising skills. Online ethics and how to promote Christian values are also themes discussed. But just why is a pontifical university sponsoring such a program? Giovanna Abbiati, Vice Director of the Athenaeum's Institute for Higher Women's Studies, says they wanted to respond to the Pope's call to know and evangelize through the digital media.
We wanted to answer to the call of the Pope about knowing the digital language, which is new, and we consider ourselves as women as a new media, because we are quite new and we want to communicate efficiently, and so that's why we propose this master in collaboration with Google.
And you also have involved other big names in the media world.
You know, the problem is that at the beginning we did this choice. Why don't we call directly those who make the communication in terms of technologies, the big expert? We don't choose big professors who probably wrote very interesting books on communication and new media. We really wanted to ask to those who communicate and do the communication. So we first asked with Google. We have very good relation with Google. And then we tried Microsoft and at the end, Facebook. And we just called them. Just help us. We want to be able to use the web, the potential of the web. We want to be trained how to communicate our values, our messages, and also how to make money. Fundraising, for example. And they answered, yes, okay, we're very happy to help. So, for example, in this master, Google just sent us three teachers, very, very good. And we talk about ethics in the matter of, for example, you know, all the problems with the privacy, with the use of the Creative Commons for downloading, uploading content on the web. And the other thing is the right of oblivium, which is that everybody has to be able just to cancel what he's doing on the web.
And all the information pertaining to them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is very important, so because we must be responsible in the web. And they want the same. We want rules, ethics, and they want the same, and they also want good content on the web, because if you don't trust the web, you don't use it well, and you don't find anything, you don't trust the web, you don't make a transition, economic transition, you don't use your credit card, you don't want to allow anybody to use it, for example, your children. So they want responsible people. Of course, they are discussing about rules. And we are discussing, too, also the relations with the technology. A human being, for example, children, they spend a lot of time in internet. And we must be able to teach them as mothers and as educators how to behave and how to use technologies.
Sure. What is safe, what's not safe, how to discern what is an accurate website to something that is just someone expressing an opinion, which could be very dangerous as well for our kids.
That's why we asked the police, the Italian police, Polizia Postale Italiana, to come and teach us how to be protected by informatic crimes. So talking about how to protect our children and ourselves with the danger of the web, because, of course, there is also this side to know well.
Sure. It seems to me that one of the other challenges that's represented by the new media that we're seeing is that in some way they are deciding what we want to know. Through their elaborate algorithms, companies like Google see that we are interested in, I don't know, in a certain political party. Say, if you're in America, say the Republicans or the Democrats, and they can see that you've been downloading all the information about the Republicans, and so they send you only the Republican side of the things that you're looking for. But it doesn't allow you the dialogue with your opponents or the other side. So the dialogue is not there. We're sort of being taken down one track and not given more opinions, more sides of the story.
That's a good question. I'm very glad you make me this question. That's why we call the number one to teach us how the web and internet, which are two different things, is built. We didn't want to have a course, for example, about, you know, the up-to-date softwares, but we call the W3 Consortium. The W3 Consortium is the one who founded Tim Berners-Lee. Tim Berners-Lee is the founder, the inventor of the web. And is a foundation, so they don't sell anything. And we ask them to come and to teach how the web and internet is built, the architecture of the web, how the algorithm is made, how you can build a searching engine. So I think to go to the foundation mechanical foundation and also the thinking of the web was very important for all these educators and for people like me or like us, like a lot of other women who want to not only to be up to date, but to have an idea of what really technology is.
Here at this point in time, we're going through an economic crisis that has affected the whole world. In Italy, you're seeing shops close. We're seeing people being laid off their jobs. What opportunities can people find on the web?
Well, that's another part which is very important in our master, for example, the entrepreneurial spirit. For the first time, we think about the computer as a domestic tool. I mean, like a washing machine, which is an algorithm as well, but the computer is more intelligent. We heard about so many examples of startups, not only in the Silicon Valley, but also in Italy, we have examples of excellence that are able to, to make money with the startup, this new idea, because the world is digitalizing everything, so it's a new field, it's a new world. So why don't we try also to empower women, stay-at-home workers, or stay-at-home persons like mothers who have to raise children or just to take care of old parents, to discover the potential of the web in terms of making a business. Why not? It's very easy to learn. You don't need 5 years of academic studies to get a degree. You don't need that. In a year, you can be able to open a website and be very good on the web. And that's something we ask directly to the number one, to Microsoft. We called Roberta Cocco, the director of social responsibility in Italy of Microsoft, and she's giving a course about digital marketing, how to open a website, how to deal with, if you want to sell something, if you want to open a blog and to make money, because this is very important also for a woman in a family who wants to help.
The new evangelization, a big theme of Pope Benedict XVI's papacy, how can the internet empower women to promote the new evangelization through the web?
I think that being in a pontifical university, we are in touch with a great spiritual resource. We have all this tradition very close to us. We can read books, we can listen to very interesting people in Catholic Church. So I think that for the first time, we can have the chance to make a bridge between tradition and innovation. Innovation is modern, is the language that everybody understands. It's the language of the world, probably technology. But of course, tradition is very important because it means that it's something we receive from the past and from the others. It cannot die. So just these two things, traditions and innovation together, can be very strong for a new evangelization, can be the right spirit just to go ahead with a new language, can reach the young people from all over the earth, with a very persuasive language, but at the same time, the richness of a tradition which is very old, very deep, and needs probably a new translation.
And a warm thanks there to Giovanna Abbiati, Vice Director of the Institute for Higher Women's Studies at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum. And that concludes our program today. Thank you so much for listening to us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.